Hi everyone, welcome to Talking Science, the most sophisticated entertainment on campus radio. For the half an hour every week, I'm Boyang, your co-host for next half an hour with Dian.
Good evening, JKU. My name is Yukich Dian, and looking forward to talking with my friend Boyang.
So, this is our first show after the Christmas holidays. I hope you had everyone has an enjoyable had an enjoyable time, or at least that you survived it, and welcome back to study. We have right now in the next 2 weeks will be the exam time, I suppose, which means that everyone will be procrastinating. Everyone will be putting things off and listening to a show. So, what news do we have from the scientific front?
Well, recently, as one extremely interesting article I've read in the 1 or 2 weeks ago, it was about the neuron system of a worm which has approximately 300 neurons in his system was simulated with a software, and the interesting outcome of this was that without programming this robot, so this software was implemented in a robot, and without programming it to do certain tasks, it behaved somewhat like the worm they have cartographed the neuron system from. Like it was avoiding obstacles, and it was moving towards sensory input, which suggested like food supply.
That is quite interesting. 300 neurons. I mean, I was remember reading Stephen Hawking. He was reading, I think it was a popular scientific book on time in a nutshell or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he talked about, one thing he talked about was intelligence and the fact that despite all the supercomputing powers we have nowadays, that none of our computers is as intelligent as an earthworm, but at least I don't know how complicated the neural system of a nerve system of an earthworm is, but at least apparently we have achieved the intelligence of a C. elegans.
It was just 300. I mean, there's still a million times difference between Caenorhabditis elegans and a Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I think this is a good start and proof of principle that it, in fact, might work. And just to make a connection, maybe a little bit to scientific entertainment. Recently, a movie came out with the title "The Imitation Game" with Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. And this movie is about Alan Turing and what happened in Hut 8 during the deciphering of Enigma. And the bridge to this topic would be that Turing was actually the first bioscientist who also engaged in philosophical questions about what is the mind, is a machine able to think? And this movie is definitely a recommendation, which any one of our listeners should watch. It's entertaining. The story is very well explained. Mm-hmm. And a very good performance from Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I've actually watched a trailer from it on an excerpt on where he was interviewed, I think by counterintelligence, because he was suspected as a Soviet spy. Mm-hmm. And where he talked about this philosophical question of intelligence, and where he introduced the Turing test, actually.
Exactly.
Although I think the circumstances were probably different. I haven't watched the movie myself, but I've heard of some rather critical reviews, which, well, you know, the usual criticism is that it's too much Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, too much dramatization where people sacrifice facts and truth for the dramatic effect.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, It is not explained, for example, of how the Enigma exactly works, or what, as the, let's say, it's a less emphasis on the scientific stuff, on how it really worked, what algorithms did they use to solve it. But it was more the movie is actually told from a very interesting perspective, because it starts So the movie itself starts after World War II, where Turing's flat got robbed, and he made the accusation. So he called the police, and during this investigation, the police found out that he was homosexual, which led then to these charges everybody knows of. And during these investigations, the story of what happened during World War II is explained in flashbacks.
Okay.
So what the movie puts into contrast is the contribution of Alan Turing, not even to the time to World War II, in mm-hmm. fact, but also what he did for today's computer science, mm-hmm. and they put it in a rough contrast to how they treated him after World War II.
Yeah,
and this is a very interesting point of view. I mean, I don't know. Most of you already know that Turing was treated very badly after World War II. Because
I'm not sure whether people know who Alan Turing is.
Yeah, Alan Turing is basically the inventor of modern computer science itself. He was the guy who built the first computer. He was the father of the Turing machine.
Yes, the theoretical framework, a Turing machine, is a model. Which is a theoretical machine that can compute everything algorithmically, and a famous term or concept in computer science is Turing complete, which means that a computer language, which is Turing complete, which means that it does the same thing, or it can everything what a Turing machine can, and that is actually, which means that it is complete, or that it is powerful enough to do all the mathematical algorithmic operations that it is supposed to.
Exactly. So
that is. Although I must insist on a correction. The first computer or programming language was apparently, and I learned that also here, by a guy called Suse, a German guy. And actually, if you work down the Verbindungstrakt, so from mm-hmm. the Bankengebäude to the Kopfgebäude, mm-hmm. there actually is a machine
really?
In the corner. And that actually is one of the earliest computers built in the, I don't know, 30s, 40s.
Shame on me. I have to check it out.
Yeah, let's have a look. It's quite fun. Anyway, Alan Turing, computer science. And yes, he committed suicide then. Which is, yeah.
And this is exactly what the movie puts into contrast. So his contributions, modern historians estimate that only by cracking the Enigma code, the war was shortened by 2 years.
Yes.
And many, many lives, at least a few million, mm-hmm. were probably saved due to his contribution. But because of top secret, because of this stuff being top secret, nobody was supposed to know, even after World War II. Mm-hmm. Because immediately after World War II, the Soviets were basically the new enemies, and they weren't supposed to know what they were able to do or not. So not even the policeman who investigated his case had access to his files, what he did during in Hut 8. So he was basically, at least in the movie, it was depicted that he claimed he worked at a radio factory.
Yeah. And which is quite funny, isn't it?
And one interesting, just to get a feeling of how important and how wide he thought his stuff, he wrote during his time in Hut 8, where he was cracking this Enigma code, he wrote, of course, also papers. And these papers were already immediately confiscated by GCHQ, which is the Secret Service of Britain. Mm-hmm. And these papers were so important that they only released it in 2012.
Yeah.
So 3 years ago they were released.
Apparently they also built a machine. They built actually kind of a computer to crack the Enigma code. And that machine and all its construction plans have been destroyed after the war. So that people... So it's kind of... I mean, as a historical interest, people can now never retrace or rebuild the first computer that was used for that actually important contribution mm-hmm. against the Nazis. As well, because of the... Apparently, they were so afraid of the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also another movie coming out, which is already out, the I forgot the name, but it is about Stephen Hawking's.
Yeah.
I've also watched a trailer. I mean, mostly I only watch trailers of the movies because you get so much information in the 2 minutes. It's probably the most...
Stop watching trailers and watch the movies.
Well, that's 2 hours, you know, that is...
Be a little bit more spontaneous.
It's a much more effective use of time by watching just only trailers. Anyway, so... I think...
And reading Wikipedia article afterwards.
Exactly, and reading... So, watching the trailer and reading the synopsis on Wikipedia. That's the way how I got all my information on movies and on pop culture.
Are you a cinemaphile?
No, I'm not. Well, yes, I like to pretend to be someone of a sophisticated taste, but the point is they are just boring. And movies with good critiques are sometimes not the most interesting ones.
Do you think that people... rate them higher because they think when they rate them higher and they like them that other people think that they're sophisticated because they like movies like that?
Apparently, I think there used to be something called the melodrama effect, which is that people that, also movies that are tragic or sad get better critics. And they are
really?
More, no, they are, no, at least they are more likely to get Oscars than comedies.
Okay.
So that is something that apparently is, it's probably still persisting that Academy Award winners are often quite sad movies, so they are rather melodramatic.
I never saw it from that point of view.
Comedic, so yeah. So I do think there's some. It's because everyone wants to pretend to be pretentious or to pretend to know things, and apparently
everybody's pretentious. This is so house-like.
Well,
it is like the Boyang equivalent to everybody lies.
Exactly.
Everybody's pretentious.
Yes, even those who pretend not to know things, they are pretentious by not knowing things.
Yeah, but by pretending not to be pretending, you're already pretending.
Exactly. So it's...
You cannot not pretend.
Yes, that is such a deep discussion on human psychology. I'm not sure whether any of our listeners can follow. So anyway. So that movie... Stephen Hawking, yeah, who, by the way, is still alive. I wonder whether he actually consented to the movie, whether he get paid for it, or because I'm pretty sure it is not true what is depicted anyway. And I don't know how much he actually, what he thinks. It would be fun to know what Stephen Hawking himself thinks of the movie.
I think this movie is even based on the memoirs.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That is interesting because Stephen Hawking. First, the movie is rather... It is not about his work. It's kind of a love story, isn't it? It's mostly about him and his girlfriend.
Yeah, but I think this is what really happened before he got his sickness.
Yes. But what happened afterwards? Because, well, doesn't matter because we're not here to discuss Stephen Hawking's private life. It might be interesting, but who cares? The funny thing is, I was the other day I was watching a... The good thing about modern times and YouTube is that Stanford and MIT, they put all their courses as open courseware on YouTube.
Brilliant.
And you can follow all the lectures.
MIT even uploads the exams and the solution to the exams.
Yes.
And the course documentation. This is quite a service.
Yes, and watching them, you might realize you're not that bad at GK or the opposite, that how more advanced they are. Well, they are not, but there are some very good professors like Leonard Susskind, who is a physicist, and there was a lecture by him or talk by him on on the world as a hologram.
Yeah, I watched it.
Oh, really?
Yes, I did.
Okay, it's quite funny. And where he talked us about
this is pretty crazy.
Apparently he used a quote by Arthur Conan. Oh, what was his name? Again, the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes. If you exclude all the impossible, then whatever remains, regardless how improbable, must be the truth or whatever.
Yeah,
something
must,
like that.
Yeah, it must be the truth.
And apparently the theory of the world as a hologram is the only way to resolve the problem of the understanding of a theory of the of the black hole based on string theory and based on quantum mechanics, quantum physics. Apparently, they have different predictions of the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And describing the universe or the reality as, I mean, it doesn't mean that we are holograms, but what he says is actually that all the information that is contained within a space, that it can be described that all the information actually can be contained on the surface of that space. So
yes.
if you have a certain
The entropy is directly proportional to the surface area.
Exactly. So if I have a room, then everything in the room that actually that all the information inside is actually be seen as a holographic depiction of the information on the walls of that room, and that is the idea. I mean, it doesn't really mean that we are holograms. It just means that holograms are a possible way of describing the universe. And well, he was mentioning Stephen Hawking, and that's how I came to that. So.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Hawking did tremendous work on it. His major breakthrough was deriving the formula of the entropy of a black hole. Because what you also was saying is that before Stephen Hawking, there was this information paradox, in which it was thought that information was lost when it got into the black hole because it's over the event horizon. The statement that there's nothing faster than light is actually not quite right. There are things that are faster than light, but when you go over it, you just don't lose the information, you just cannot access it. And when you define entropy in a wider array, when you say, okay, everything what entropy is basically is not accessible information.
Mm-hmm.
And he solved this information paradox, and it concluded that it, in fact, is the only thing that counts is the surface area of the black hole itself, and not the three-dimensional space of it.
Yes, and of course, he's also quite famous for the Hawking's radiation, which says that people thought that nothing escapes a black hole, but apparently rotating black holes, they do emit energy, or at least particles, in form of Hawking radiations.
And they basically evaporate.
Yes, that's what happens, apparently. Well, I mean, I've never seen a black hole, so it's very hard to confirm that information empirically.
Yeah, be thankful that you haven't seen one.
Well, nobody has actually seen one. That's the point about the black hole, isn't it? That it is invisible, so we only see the lack of things, and we see that is because there's a black hole there. But
because there's nothing there.
Yes, or because there's darkness, and that's why we call it black hole. But and black holes, it does not contradict our current theories, and apparently we do not have better explanations for this dark spot. So we simply postulate a black hole in it, and then we derive all the funny equations and theories based on quantum mechanics and gravitation and the general theory of gravitation, and we come to crazy solutions, and we believe, well, but in the end, who knows?
Exactly.
So yes, that is on the cosmological front. Otherwise, science-wise, yeah, in the last few days, I've been reading a paper by Huerta Sanchez. I'm not very good with Spanish, so I hope I pronounced her name correctly. That appeared last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the intro. Well, the fact is that the Tibetans, they have a version of APOS1 gene. APOS1 is a transcription factor so the gene expresses a protein which controls the expression of other genes, so the production of other proteins. And APOS1 controls the level of blood red cells in the blood of hemoglobin. What it does is a major problem with high altitude. So if you live on the Tibetan plateau, is that there is less oxygen above there. So you have a decrease of 20% of atmospheric pressure, 20 or 40%, which means, or 40%, yes, it's actually 40% less lower than at the sea level. So you have a hypoxic environment with low oxygen, which means that our body try to compensate by producing more red blood cells so that we have more oxygen transporters. Exactly. The problem with that, of course, is that having more red blood cells also means that you have that there's that one is hypertension, so high blood pressure. Other than that is that you increase the chance of hemorrhages, especially at pregnancy.
Okay.
There are often complications involved, especially with when you have blood loss, and things like that. So the Tibetans, they have a version of this gene which causes them to have a lower infant mortality. They have higher fertility, and because that gene actually does not cause. So what it does is that actually it does not. Increases the blood hemoglobin as much as a normal common variant. So the Tibetans, they actually have the same level of blood hemoglobin as us, despite the fact that they live so much higher with so much less oxygen.
But does the hemoglobin itself also look differently?
No. It's the APOS1 is only the transcription factor. I mean, it is possible that actually their version of the hemoglobin is more effective, but that is not the point of that paper.
Yeah,
so it only looks at this transcription factor, which causes the increase in blood hemoglobin, but not in the structure of the hemoglobin itself.
But if I've understood you correctly, then we also have this transcription factor, but only they express more of it.
No,
or less.
What our version does is our version causes this transcription factor is induced by low oxygen environment. So if we get into a low oxygen environment, this transcription factor causes more blood hemoglobin to be expressed to be produced. And the Tibetan version of that gene does not.
Interesting.
Which means same level of blood hemoglobin, and which is beneficial for. I mean, I think the crazy things what athletes do is that they often go into a high altitude environment so that their body produces more hemoglobin, and then they have this blood removed and cooled.
Exactly.
And then when they at a competition, they insert themselves in the blood so that they have more hemoglobin in the blood.
Exactly.
But having that increased level of hemoglobin over a long period is actually quite deleterious. So it's actually negative for your body. And the Tibetans apparently have found a way to work around that.
Interesting.
Yes. The researchers found is that their version, so it is actually the gene itself is, I think, about 120 kilobases long. So that means 100,000 bases long. But there's only one region of it. It's about 30 kilobases long, which is very different from all the other versions, and they concentrated on that. They focus on that region, and based on their methods based on what the on simulations they have done, they concluded that, well, the Tibetans are most related to the Han Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's from a linguistic point of view, the split of the Proto-Sino-Tibetans was likely 6,000 or 8,000 or 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then you split into the Chinese, the Tibetans, and the Burmese, etc. Although I'm not really sure about the exact timeline or even the exact structure of the family tree of the Sino-Tibetan language. That is also very debated, but that's what we have. So the Han Chinese being a very close relatives of the Tibetans. So they compare that to the Han Chinese, and mm-hmm. they realize the differences are so large that it cannot be because of some new mutations in the yep. Tibetans, but that it was probably from some that it was that they probably got that introgressed from a donor population, so that they got that version really? From a different population.
So they are maybe suggesting that there were already different humans up there, which had relations with Tibetans when they
were interbreeding. Well, that is very speculative to postulate any other hominin groups on the Tibetan plateau. That's not what they said. What they said is that they compared that to other populations, to the Europeans, Africans, Americans, etc.
Yeah.
And they found actually, and they also compared it to a Denisovan genome that has been sequenced 2 years ago. So it is a very high quality sequence. And they realized that it is most similar to the Denisovan sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And they did also some other simulations and calculations, and they realized it is impossible that we inherited from the same ancestors. So one possibility is that the Denisovans and the humans, we actually had that haplotype, so that version of the gene
mm-hmm.
in common, but it survived in the in the Denisovans and Tibetans, but got lost in all the other populations.
Understand, yeah.
But that is very, very unlikely mm-hmm. because you would expect, at least in such a short period, you would expect much higher frequency of this version appearing in other populations. But the fact is, it is only in the Tibetans.
Yeah, I understand.
Two times in two Han Chinese and nowhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So only the Tibetans, for which it is a common haplotype, so it is the majority version in the Tibetans, and in the Denisovans, or in that one Denisovan genome we have, and into Han Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's basically, but there is a prevalence within the Han Chinese that they have it definitely.
They do have that version, and they also a possibility is that the Han Chinese and the Tibetans have that gene in common. So, and that it was lost in the Han Chinese and it prevailed in the Tibetans.
Mm-hmm.
But they did that a simulation on the which is called the selection on sending variation. So assuming there is already a variation, that this variant already exists
mm-hmm.
among the Proto-Sino-Tibetan populations.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do a simulation to see how much then the... So after the split into Han and Tibetans, how much the two haplotypes should differ. And they realized that based on their simulations, which of course it's... For simulations, you have to assume parameters and sometimes maybe your model itself is wrong or maybe your parameters are wrong. But their data shows that... their simulation do not come to such level of differentiation.